I'm out of practice.
Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 229th episode of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Kyle Barton of Waterfront Windsors, and I'm here with my co-host Diami Plotke of the Penultimate Woodshop. Tonight, we're talking amongst ourselves. So, with that said, I'm glad to be back on the podcast.
Welcome back, my friend.
So, anyone that follows my Instagram feed knows I've had a little bit been under the weather with some health issues, but never fear, that's all getting better, and I'll talk a little bit more about that coming up. But before we get to that, I just wanted to talk about a few things that piqued my interest. And Diami, do you have anything?
My interest has been not piqued.
Not piqued.
No. Go in. Let's go into this stuff. I've actually had some productive shop time, but
we'll
get to that in due time.
Yeah, in due time. So I guess the first thing, and I don't want to put a downer on the podcast, but I do want to send our condolences out regarding the passing of David Savage last Friday. That's January 18th. As many of y'all probably know, he just released a book, and he was fighting cancer. And I know Chris Swartz, who published the book, Lost Art Press. I know they were trying to get that out before he did pass, and they were able to. So he enjoyed that, and the book is called The Intelligent Hand. And I have not read that book yet, but it seems to be, it's gotten great reviews, and it's about David Savage's life as a furniture designer and builder. Hmm. And all the craftsmanship. And he builds, I don't know if you've ever looked at some of his work, but
no,
you know,
I'm not familiar with him.
Yeah, he's from England. But he has built some wild, wild looking things. Most of his customers are very wealthy. So, you know, he's been able to experiment with some wild designs. And some of his chairs are just fascinating. And you look at them and go, wow, that's wild. And then the second thing is, how the hell did he do that? You know, a lot of bent laminations, probably some steam work and some stuff like that. But he builds all sorts of casework. And I think he has a school that there too, I believe, and in England to teach folks. But it is sad that he passed. But and our condolences out to all of his family and friends. And anyway. But
it's always sad when the community loses a wonderful artist. I'm just looking at his chairs now, and they are stunning.
Yeah, they're pretty incredible. And anyone that's out there, I encourage you all to look at his work. And if it piques your interest like it does mine, head over to Lost Art Press and buy the book. Like I said, I've heard lots of great things about it, and it's definitely a book I'm going to pick up as soon as I get caught up on the 14 million books I haven't read yet that are sitting over here that are staring in my bookshelf. Yeah, Lost Art Press is putting them out so quickly, but so hopefully I'll get to them, especially in my recovery. I should be able to get some quality reading time in. So let's see here. So
cleaner. What is this?
This is something I think I mentioned
round ones
before. Yeah. And it was like always out there, and you know, it wasn't shipping and there wasn't any pricing on it, but it's Axion Stratus air cleaner. And it's kind of like a cylinder that's about 4 feet high or so, it looks like. And it's supposed to be a really effective cleaner. And what it's totally different, but it kind of reminds me of that Powermatic air cleaner that just came out that you could move around. Mm. that is also very expensive. but this thing
doesn't come cheap.
Yeah, this thing looks a little bigger. Couple of things that might be a detractor. I think the Powermatic, I don't know. I should have looked it up and see how much that weighed, but this thing weighs 70 pounds. So it's not, you know, it would be fairly easy to move around the way it's shaped and stuff. You could pretty much wrestle it around without much work,
it's got
but
a
still
ring about looks, it's next to a workbench. So I'm going to assume that ring is about 30 inches high and looks like just a big round handle that wraps around it. So I'm thinking you kind of tip it a little bit and roll it.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you know, I saw some videos of it. You know, they say there's what, about 9,000 square inches of exposed filter media, but it's designed to be placed right nearby where you're creating the dust. And it's, you know, floor based. So they say, hey, the dust is falling to the floor. So it's kind of taken that natural, I guess, aspect of dust falling by gravity towards the floor and sucking it up. And it has, there's two versions of it. There's kind of like a standard model, which costs, looks like $549, and a pro model. And I think the pro model has a charcoal, active charcoal filter in it. So you could use it for, you know, some VOC type concerns.
And, do you think it would be good enough for VOC? I would think you'd still want a mask on.
I think you'd still want a mask on, but maybe it would help, you know. Clean the air a little bit better. So, you know, you can clean the air in the shop. So you don't, you know, if you're spraying inside a shop or inside something like that, I've never done that. I guess maybe it would be good. You know, even if you're doing a wiping varnish, you always wear a respirator. So that could help air out the shop and keep the shop from stinking as much as it normally does. Cause it usually takes a day or two for that residual smell to go away. But that model, the pro model that has that active charcoal filter, that's another $200. So that's $749. But what I think would be interesting, because I certainly don't have the money to do these tests, is for some magazine or something to put this up against, you know, the Powermatic versus the typical ceiling mounted unit that you see, and just see what the effective air cleaning capacity of each of those units are and how well they work. So hopefully that'll come out, because $549 is a bit much. And I don't think the Powermatic's much cheaper than that. I think it may be a little bit, but not much.
No, but that is it's a bit pricey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Axiom is the company that makes CNCs. Is Axiom owned by one of the distributors? They make CNCs that are only sold through somebody. Let me just see.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, they do make CNCs and I think some other type units. Let's see here. But
yeah, they figure it out. Their CNCs are like the Piranha, but they're labeled differently. So I don't know who makes whose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know either. But anyway, but it looked like a pretty interesting piece of equipment.
Given how interested you were when these were first introduced, and now that they're, I guess, coming into the field, when do you get yours?
I want to see that test first. You know, my air cleaner is the that I currently have in my shop is the old box fan with a filter on the side, and hey, it works all right.
I have the nice the jet ceiling mounted one.
Please tell me it's in the attic.
No, it's hanging up the ceiling. It's directly
above. Oh, really? Oh, okay.
It's directly above me right now.
Sorry, I couldn't resist. yeah, how do you like it?
Oh, it's fantastic! It's absolutely fantastic. Okay. Now, I have a very small shop, so it would be hard to be underpowered, but it seems to have plenty of power. And if I remember right, it's been years that Fine Woodworking did the test on them. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this won Best Value or I don't think this won overall, but it did well in the test.
Right.
And it was like a Black Friday sale or something. I remember like lots of people got them because it was on sale for like $250 or I don't remember what I paid for it. I've had it a long time. But I remember when I got it, it was discounted hugely. And I said, oh, that's a really cheap price. And it rated well, so I just got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I have not been disappointed. It's got a remote. You set the timers. It's nothing fancy, but it's nothing more than it needs to be. Like, it just works.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing that interests me about this particular one is, you know, since it's low to the ground and, you know, I wonder if it'd be good for, you know, if you're sanding like on a lathe or something like that, because that just kicks up all kinds of dust and spreads out. So I wonder if it'd be any good at capturing that before it got, you know, to the other side of the shop.
Would you be better off with one of those hoods and just connecting it to a dust collector?
Yeah, I need to try that. I got the dust collector. I got one of those big wide hood things. You know, but it seems like a pain because you would have to, as you're sanding, move that hood back and forth, or that big wide mouth thing. So it looks, you know, I'm not sure how well that would work. You know, Rockler had this little vacuum attachment for a lathe, and I actually bought it sight unseen, and basically when the box arrived, I looked at it, kind of messed with it a little bit, went, this is never going to work for what I'm doing. It might work for, like, if you're turning pins or more small objects, but not like legs and things like that. I went, okay, this goes back. So, you know, I never really tried it out. I just, you know, once I opened the box and kind of played with it for about 10 minutes, I went, yeah, this is not going to work for what I'm doing. So, but yeah, but hopefully, you know, one of the magazines, Fine Woodworking, et cetera, will do a test on these, because I would be very excited to see that. And let's see, the other thing that piqued my interest was catching up on some YouTube. You know, Brian McCauley and Brandon Marshall, friends of the podcast, they have the YouTube channel Workshop Review. They actually did a review on a new finish by Total Bolt, a Total Boat, and it's called the Helicon Rugged Marine Varnish. Mm-hmm. And you can buy it at Jamestown Distributors. What interests me is it's not that expensive. It was, I think it's like $30. Yeah, $29.99 for the kit. And I'd recommend people go out to their YouTube channel and take a look at this. It reminded me of kind of marine varnish version of Osmo, of all things, the way it kind of looked and went on. They're saying you don't have to sand between coats. You can sand after the final coat, and usually you put two or three coats on and just to smooth it out. But it's supposed to be, you know, marine quality. And the only thing that was kind of disappointing was it only came in a gloss, which I'm not a big fan of.
It comes
glossy.
In clear amber or clear gloss.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the clear amber, I think, is also gloss.
Yeah.
Now, yeah. And that was the second thing that was interesting, is you could get, you know, like a very clear finish, or you could get the amber finish, and they seem to prefer the amber finish, and they said the gloss wasn't that bad. So I'd be wondering if you could, you know, with sanding it, maybe you could knock down some of the gloss.
That's what I was going to say, is if you're really against the gloss, you could always knock it down.
Yeah. But
how does it get applied?
With
a rag, with a brush, with?
Yeah, they, I believe they applied it with a brush, a foam brush. It comes with a foam brush. You can also roll it on. Yeah.
I'm looking at it now, and it comes with two paint. In the kit is the finish, mm-hmm. two paint pots, two stir sticks, two foam brushes, two strainers, and one pair of latex gloves.
Yeah.
And that's all for $30. So that is not bad at all. How big is the kit? It is
I think it's a quart. Let's see. Looking here, I want to say they said it was a quart, but I do not see on there. Huh? You would think it would say right there on the website. So.
It's 1 quart. It is. I just zoomed in on the picture.
Okay.
But it is 1 quart.
Okay.
So that's not terrible. That's I still think that's a decent deal.
Yeah, yeah, especially to try it. I mean, I heard all about Osmo, and when I tried it, it was like almost $50 for a cord, I think. Yeah. That stuff's not cheap. Yeah, I might give that a try and see what I think. Like I said, now they also, in going down, you know me and finishes.
I do. That's why I'm
shiny
laughing.
Object. Let's go. One thing I also notice is they also have a line of epoxy. This wouldn't happen to be the brand of epoxy you use for your entertainment center, would it?
It absolutely is.
Okay. So what did you think about the epoxy?
It's nice stuff.
Really? Yeah.
It was competitive with the price of the, was it three? Is the other system? Not three.
West.
Is the system, but West is the one I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a teeny bit cheaper. Mm-hmm. But when we had... When we had the guys, Freddie Roman and Guy Dunlap and Justin on, this is what Justin had recommended.
Okay.
And it worked out. It worked out fine. In fact, I'm stroking it now.
When I saw that, I went, I'm almost sure that's what Diami used, because it looks like they have two different types of epoxy, one more of a, let's glue stuff together, and one more of a thing for filling, I guess in the boat industry, one for actually gluing pieces of wood together and holding them together in a watertight manner, and the other one for, like doing fiberglass work and things like that. Because it's like 2-to-1 or 1-to-1. I think there's a 2-to-1 epoxy, and then there's that's more for doing fiberglass work or filling in knots in our case or voids. And then the other one was like a 5-to-1, and that looked like it was more of a a glue type epoxy.
Yeah, and looking at the ratio of one container to the other, I'm assuming I have the 5-to-1. It is in my shop now. Both cans I can see, but they're turned, so I can only see the backs of them, so I can't read what's in the front. And the catalog they send with them is incredibly thick, an amazing variety of products, all geared towards boats, frankly. They are Jamestown Distributor. Total Boat is a brand of Jamestown Distributor.
Okay.
They're affiliated with each other. I think Jamestown owns Total Boat or vice versa. Mm-hmm. The catalog goes through an enormous array of different products they have. But what I found nice is that they were a total system, which I think West can be. But I experimented with three different thickeners, all of which I got from them. They were all their thickeners.
Mm-hmm.
It came with the buckets and the mixing gloves. And they do a nice deal. And from what I see, I didn't actually interact with them myself, but they seem to have decent customer service, and they're happy to walk you through the steps of what you're doing and what the right product is and things like that. How do you use it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a good point. Yeah. I think I'll have to try that out as soon as I have the West system now. And as soon as if I ever run out of that, it seems like this has to be getting low. It's been, 8 years since I bought it.
It's funny,
but the one thing I liked about the epoxy, from what I've heard, is the Total Boat version. You don't, with the West system, it seems like you make a lot of epoxy. I don't need as much as the pumps pump out, and it seems like the Total Boat, it's a little bit less epoxy that's pumped out. So
I was pumping.
But you were, yeah, you were.
So I don't know what you're talking about. I will say, I did all the bar tops or entertainment center tops with it. But recently I needed a little bit of epoxy for the Pinewood Derby cars, because you use some epoxy there too. And rather than relearn my ratios, I just went out and bought 5-Minute Gorilla.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yeah. That's always an option. What else was I going to add? Oh, yeah. Just a pro tip here. If you are in the market for epoxy, and you're looking at West, or I guess this Total Boat, I have found that it's cheaper if you actually go to a boat supply store, a marine store, and then if you go to the woodworking store. Just FYI.
I've priced West at
Online they're about the same, but if you have to run out and get some.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, see if you got a marine store somewhere around.
See, those I have an abundance of. I don't have woodwork.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. 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 If you're in Iowa or something, it might be a little hard. But, you know, who knows? They have lakes there, I assume.
There is actually a West Marine on Lake George upstate. So,
hey, there you go. Yeah. That West Marines, there's probably three of those within 20 minutes of me.
I know what two are, but anyway.
Yeah.
So what's going on in your shop, Kyle?
So right now it's recovery. So those of you that follow me on Instagram know that I was diagnosed. Now it's been about 2 weeks with, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a nerve disorder. So the luck thing about it is caught it really early. It basically happens overnight. And I got treated right away, so hopefully my recovery will be shorter. And basically what happened was Thursday I was fine, woke up Friday, and then noticed I had some coordination problems in walking up and down stairs, felt really weird. And then I thought, well, let's see what's going on. Saturday, my fingertips started tingling, like I think I described it to you in a text that it was like I had a Harbor Freight random orbit sander that I used all day long. And you know how your hands just kind of vibrate for hours after you do that? That's the way my fingertips felt. And that started getting worse on Sunday. And I still had the balance problems. And of course, I'm on the internet, looking at all these things, and saying,
you can't do that.
I got nerve cancer or something like that, but I did see this Guillain-Barré syndrome, and I went, well, that's really rare, and surely I don't have that. It's got to be something else. And I went and looked at neurological hospitals in my area. The good thing about Houston is it's the capital of hospitals, basically. The Texas Medical Center is the largest medical center in the world and has just hospitals after hospitals. So there's real good health care here in Houston. And I did see that Houston Methodist had the one of the number one rated neurological institutes in the country. So I went, okay, well, Monday morning I'll go into work and make an appointment. So I went into work Monday morning. Still felt weird, as far as coordination, but I could get around. And went and told my boss about it. My boss says, nah, we're going to the emergency room. So my boss and another friend of mine from work drove me to the emergency room. I went, well, I want to go to Houston Methodist. So they got me right in. And
you work in Houston?
Yeah, I work in Houston. Okay. Yeah. I work in the medical center in Houston. So it's just down the road. I work at MD Anderson Cancer Center, which is the number one cancer hospital in the nation. So so went right down the road to Houston Methodist, and they got me checked in and got excellent care. I mean, that day I had CAT scan, MRI, all kinds of blood work, all kinds of tests like that. Mm-hmm. And just, they're trying to rule out everything. They even tested me for heavy metals and all kinds of things.
Can I just stop you for one second?
Yeah.
I don't mean to, I want to hear the rest of your story. Mm. But you mentioned heavy metals, and I read, the listener will have to forgive me, I don't know where I read this, but an artist, Seattle sticks in my head, but I don't know, who made sculptures out of fish shells, like mussel shells and clam shells and things.
Mm-hmm. Mercury and poisoning?
Heavy metal poisoning.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting.
She worked with them as a medium for like 20 years, and between the shells themselves and consuming an above average amount of seafood, because she liked the fish, so she would sometimes just get shells, sometimes she'd buy the fish and eat it and then use the shells. And just life-threatening, really bad heavy metal poisoning. So that was the first thing I had read about heavy metal poisoning recently, so that's kind of brought it up that you wouldn't expect it from that, but it just shows the toxins that are out there. But I'm glad you don't have that, because it's nasty
stuff.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, and you know, even, you know, vitamin deficiencies, all kinds of things they were looking for. And so they said, well, we're going to admit you into the hospital.
Because it seemed serious or because they just didn't know?
It seemed serious because, you know, it was like Thursday I was fine. And then Friday, you know, boom. And then it just, you know, kept getting worse and worse and worse.
Okay.
So I think that's, you know, that's basically why they said, hey, we're, you know, we need to figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
So they admitted me in. And got a room there, I guess, Monday about 7 p.m. because they're waiting for a room to open up in the neurological wing. And it had just opened. It opened a month ago. So I was in a brand new wing of the hospital. And, man, we went into the room and I went, are we in the VIP suite? And I went, no, that's on the 20th floor. But, I mean, it was for a hospital room, it was pretty nice. I was like, went to the right place, obviously. But like I said, they had wonderful care there. The next day, the neurological team, about five folks, came in and visited with me. And the doctor then said, I think you might have this Guillain-Barré syndrome, or GBS. And he said, there's, you know, hey, I could send you home today, and there's a 30% chance you get better, or we can just assume this is what you have and start treatment right away. And he goes, but there are a couple additional tests we want to run, one being a spinal tap. Went, great. So I did get a spinal tap. They call it a lumbar puncture. The doctor called it.
Stick a giant needle in your spine and suck stuff out?
Yeah. So that was big fun. It wasn't quite as bad as I thought, but definitely wouldn't recommend it to anybody. But, so they did that and, then start me on this treatment, which is called IVIG, which is a, antibodies that have been gathered from, donors. And okay. They basically put those antibodies in you that kind of hopefully will, you know, redirect or form the bad antibodies that your system is generating that are attacking your nerve cells. So, I did.
It's an autoimmune deficiency.
It's autoimmune disease, basically, or syndrome. Mm. You know, like I said, the prognosis is most everyone recovers, but it takes weeks to months to recover. So that's the good point. But supposedly this treatment's supposed to lessen it and hopefully get the recovery. And I think it has worked. And they said the treatments are good for about, you know, I forgot exactly what he said, but somewhere around 4 to 6 weeks. So if I don't get any better or I get a little worse, like they can always do another round. But the treatment was 3 days of these IVs treatments. Oh, okay. And each treatment lasts about 6 hours or so.
And I'm assuming you need to be in the hospital for them.
Yeah, they said if I had to do another one, they could do it on an outpatient basis. But, okay. You know, you'd still be in a clinic for like 6 hours while you're getting this treatment. Mm. So
you said that they started the treatment prior to the final diagnosis.
Yeah.
Do you have the final diagnosis at this point?
Well, I will know tomorrow for sure. I go back and visit with my doctor, but I'm pretty sure if I self-diagnose myself. The one thing that that proves it for sure is a antibody test. So they're looking for if you have elevated levels of these certain type of antibodies. Okay. And that test takes about 2 weeks. So they, you know, ordered the test when I was in the hospital and just got the results yesterday. It showed up on my online chart. So I looked through that and sure enough, this one particular antibody, I think the normal range was 1 to 50. And I think my range was like 180 or so. So definitely elevated. And they did say, yeah, that's a sign of actually a variation of the Guillain-Barré syndrome called Miller-Fisher syndrome. So not only do I have a rare disease, but I have an even rarer subset of that disease, so or syndrome. So it was fantastic news. So anyway, we'll like I said, that's just speculation on my part. When I see the doc tomorrow, I'm sure he'll tell me for sure, you know, if that's it or not. So, but the treatment for both are the same. So that's a good thing.
Okay. Well, good. I'm glad. And you're already receiving the treatment So hopefully,
I've already had the treatment. Yeah, I've already had the treatment, so I'm good for a few weeks. And like I said, I don't know if I said it on the podcast, but last week I had some substantial improvement. This week, some better improvement. My muscles aren't quite as sore. I had trouble sleeping more than 3 hours at a time without my muscles just screaming at me, and felt better to move around and loosen them up a little bit. But that's reduced somewhat, so I'm actually sleeping a lot better. Excellent. And but it's kind of more now. The recovery is kind of more just a little bit better each day. So we'll hopefully it'll be a few weeks and I'll be back to normal. But I'm feeling good. I'm in good spirits. Wife's been taking great care of me. I'm sure she's absolutely tired of me being at home all the time. But
just getting used to next week.
So, but while I was in the hospital, I did I didn't do any woodworking, but I did order new tool. So
I bet.
Yeah, of course. So I have one of Claire Minihan's Travishers, the mm-hmm. standard sweep, which is, pretty well swept. And I wanted one that was a lower sweep. So I ordered, I put
a little bit flatter. Okay.
So I contacted her a few months ago about getting one. She goes, I'll put you on a list. So I'm in the hospital in the bed and get an email from her saying, hey, production time's ramped up a little bit and I'm to your order. So you still want this? So I'm in the hospital doing PayPal back and forth.
You said, yes, I still want it.
Yes, I still want it. So so hopefully I'll have that in a week or two. So looking forward to that. But, there's really nothing I can do in the shop right now. I don't want to be around any spinning or sharp blades, but I do feel well enough that I think I'm going to do some shop organization. I got a bunch of cabinets and things that I need to clean out and go through and rearrange some stuff. I think I can do that. I can't lift anything heavier, nor do I want to, but I think, just cleaning out some cabinets and so forth. And with that, I may actually be putting some things up for sale because I do have a few things that I just don't use anymore that I think someone might want. So follow me on Instagram. I know one thing. I have the Veritas sharpening system, the Mark II sharpening system.
The honing guides?
Yeah, the honing guides, yeah.
Don't put that up.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I said sharpening system. Yeah, I meant honing guides. So I have that.
Don't put that up for sale.
Why not?
Because I'll be in Texas in a couple weeks.
A couple of months. Okay. Well, there you go. All right, I found a taker for that. Yeah, I've got the Lee Nielsen one, and I kind of like that one better. But if you're interested, you got that. But I have some other stuff that, I bought. It's all quality stuff, not been abused.
Did you ever, all right, the very first woodworking in America we were at, you were hot to get a slow speed grinder. Did you ever do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have two of them.
Of course you do.
they're nothing special. They're, for a while there, Woodcraft had one that was about $100, but mm-hmm. the reviews were horrible on it. And I got the Rikon version, okay. Not the professional one, but just their standard. It's before they came out with the professional one. I think it's about $100 too, or maybe a little over $125 or so. You can find them on sale all the time. But yeah, the 8-inch slow speed grinder, and I've been relatively happy with those.
You have two of the same one?
Yeah, two of the same one.
Why two?
So. Well, I got on one of them, I have my two CBN wheels on there for, doing regular grinding and stuff of that nature. Then on the other one, I have a, what's it called? I forgot who makes it. Is it 3M that makes it? It's called a Beartex wheel. And it really helps kind of sharpen, hone. It's kind of a deburring wheel, but it works very well for sharpening some things like gouges and stuff. And then on the other side, I just have one of those standard white wheels for, you know, just grinding, you know, whatever I need to grind roughly, you know. Mm-hmm. Like if I have a screw I need to shorten, that's go to that white wheel. So that's why I have two of those, two grinders. So I could actually use a buffer, but I'm anyway, I get carried away sometimes. I actually have an attachment that'll fit into my lathe that'll hold a buffing wheel. So I can also use my lathe if I need to. But so I made a little table for my grinders and stuff. I think it's posted somewhere in my Instagram feed way back when. But like I said, I'm going to go through my shop. I'm sure I'll come across a lot of stuff that, you know, that I either want to sell or maybe find a new home for. I do have a new, what's interesting is I am doing physical therapy, and my physical therapist his name's Kevin, has just got into woodworking. He's at the stage of, you know, doing building stuff using pocket holes and plywood. And, you know, he's at that beginning stage. You know, he has like a DeWalt table saw. He does have a router table. You know, he's just starting to get into stuff. So he was asking me today because, you know, when I first met him, we started going into him. Of course, I steered him quickly over to Mark's website. I go, and you got to go to the Wood Whisperer, first of all. He's got a great free content. And then he has the Guild with some good stuff. You know, I go, if you go to the Guild, you know, do the shaker table. That's what you need to do. That's the first project you need to build. Yeah. Everyone has to build that at least once. I was talking to him today, and he was doing a little box for his wife, just needed to be functional, wasn't that pretty. And he goes, what do you know about these locked miter bits? I went, okay, first of all, from what I've heard, they're finicky as hell to set up.
The Infinity setting jig is supposed to actually make them workable.
That's what I've heard, and that's what I told him. I said, yeah, I think I know you can buy setup blocks, and I believe Infinity makes one that makes them a little bit easier to set up. And I go, and number two, there's actually a online contest years ago, and I want to say it was Vanderlist Router Bit of the Month. And I actually... Yeah, exactly. I actually won an Infinity. I think it was Infinity. It might have been. Was he sponsored by Infinity or Whiteside? No, I forgot.
I think he was Whiteside. He wasn't Infinity. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, I'm pretty sure that's where I got it. I could be wrong, but I actually have a locked miter set. And I go, you know what? I don't even think I've taken the wax off that. I go, I will give it to you.
See, after I'm surprised our next you didn't section. Steer him towards Matt's book. Towards Matt's book.
Oh, the boxes. Yeah, this wasn't a box of that nature. This was a box he was building for his wife, so his wife could do. She does. I couldn't really follow it. I guess it's a thing. She does some sort of decorating those Yeti koozies or something like that, and she needed some box where she could spin this thing so the whatever she puts in there, the epoxy would level itself and. I couldn't follow that. I'm going to have to get on her Etsy page and actually see what this looks like.
I'm not following you right now.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't follow it. But yeah, this was like a box that was more functional than, you know, than anything else. And he goes, well, how would you do it? And I go, got a brad nailer? Yeah. Go put some rabbits in the end and brad nail, you know. Glue and brad nails if you just need something
he's
functional.
He's into pocket holes. Pocket holes will make you a nice square box.
Yeah. I told him that's he goes, that's an option too, so. But I'm having a good time
learning
talking.
A new lock miter joint.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, he's, you know, I remember when I just first got into everything, you know, you think, you know, shiny objects with, finishing now, everything was a shiny object back then. So it's kind of interesting to, you know, talk with him and, you know, just see how energetic and, you know, wide eyed he is. It's great. It's fantastic. So hopefully, you know, I can point him in the right direction for some things, you know. You know, he asked me today about dovetails. What about dovetails? Do you have a dovetail jig? And I went, nah, I don't do that many dovetails. And when I do, I just cut them by hand. Oh, really? Wow, that sounds hard. I go, no, it's not that hard. Probably take less time to do them, you know, if you just got a few than it would to set up a jig. Cause,
yeah, that's the thing, is it depends how many.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If I was doing a whole casework with it, yeah, I'd probably go with the dovetail jig. But, you know, just for a couple, a few joints for a drawer or something, it's not a big deal. Especially if you're lazy like me. Oh, you should put four dovetails in there. Nah, I think two will work. Just make them big. But anyway, so enough about me. So what's going on in the shop with you? I've seen you post some stuff about the entertainment center. Looks like it's coming right along.
Yeah, the entertainment center is moving along. I don't think I've touched it since the last podcast, but it's making for a much better desk in my shop now, because the main components of the entertainment center are four big, huge horizontal slabs. And over the Christmas break, I applied dye and finish to all four of them. And the three that are not the top are currently down in the basement, which is where this unit will get assembled and finished. They are basically ready for assembly. I've already done all the joinery in them. The piece that will serve as the top is currently in my shop serving as a desk. It's spanning from my table saw to my I have one of those rigid flip outfeed supports.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love those things. Those are great.
They're great. I have one holding up the other end of this thing. So it's still down the middle of my shop like it has been. But it's just one of them, not all four of them. So it's much lower now. It's nice. And the reason I kept this one in the shop is because the finish is absolutely fine. But because the surface is this weird pot-marked half epoxy, half timber strand. I put four coats of a shop made wiping varnish on them. It's a 50-50 poly and mineral spirits. It's a nice finish. I've liked it on a lot of projects and it looks good, but it's not, four wiping coats are not thick enough to even out the finish. So the gloss is very different between the wood parts and the epoxy parts, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
And on the lower shelves that are going to have shelves on directly above them, I don't care. So they're fine. They're downstairs. This one that is going to be the top, I'm going to apply a couple more coats to and try to get it to be consistent. I think I'm going to go to full poly or maybe like an 80-20 poly mineral spirits mix and brush on a heavier coat. And then I think I'll still finish with some wiping coats, but I want to try to cheat a little bit. Cheat's probably not the right word, but I want to build finish faster. So I think I'm going to go with some, I haven't brushed a clear finish on it. I don't remember the last time I did. So I think I'm going to try brushing the next coat to just get a heavier coat on, because I'm looking to build a finish at this point.
So if you still run into those problems, you might have, I was thinking you might just have to, what do they say? Finish the finish.
Yeah.
Where you just abrade it with some, you know, high grit sandpaper and try to see if you can, you know, get it all to an even sheen across.
Yeah. I think that building it will do it. Cause when I touch it, some parts feel like wood, some parts feel like plastic, cause there's so much epoxy in this thing. So I think I just need to get the wooden parts as shiny as the epoxy parts, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
We'll see. There's nothing wrong with it as it is now. It's just not what I want. So ultimately if I put a couple coats on and I'm not seeing a tangible difference, then it'll be what it is now. It's dry, it's hard, it's smooth. It looks fine. In my head, I know what I want, and that's not what it is. So I'm really just continuing to apply finish for my own sake, not because the piece really needs it. I could say it was done now, and I don't think anyone would say otherwise.
So what's the process of installing these things once you get this top shelf done?
Behind it on my table saw is this stack of Baltic birch plywood. And what I did was I took I took two layers of half-inch Baltic birch and laminated them together, so it's as close to a true one-inch as you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And there are four vertical risers in between each of the horizontal shelf units.
Right.
So the bottom four are roughly 12 inches high.
Okay.
And they have kind of a scoop cut out of the bottom back corner because it's going on a wall that has a baseboard.
Right.
And that's why the bottom piece is only 12 inches wide, whereas the top three shelves are 16 inches wide.
Okay.
So that they're all even in the face, but it allows a reveal in the back to accommodate the baseboard. So these have this curve scooped out of them to accommodate the baseboard. And then, so you'll have just a sub base that's almost like a toe kick that's just made of 2x4 with a 1x4 on the outside that's going to get painted matte black.
Right.
And that's going to go on the floor. And then it gets a purple shelf on top of that. And the purple shelf overhangs that by about 2 inches in every dimension.
Mm-hmm.
Then it gets four of these vertical risers approximately 12 inches high. Then it gets another horizontal shelf. Then it gets four horizontal risers vertical risers about 6 inches high, another vertical shelf, four more risers about 6 inches, and then the top.
Mm-hmm.
So all those riser pieces are cut, glued together, trimmed square, milled, dominoed, and ready to be sanded and finished.
Okay. So that's going to be my next question. Yeah. So you're going to use dominoes to attach the risers to the
Everything's been dominoed. I have over in the corner this big, it's kind of like a story stick, but it's got these two arms that come out. Mm-hmm. And I use that. I dominoed off of each end. So the two verticals that are towards the left were both referenced off the left end, and the two verticals that are towards the right were referenced off the right end. So I was able to take this piece and flip it over itself.
Yeah,
and I made these plywood shims so that I would put this story stick piece on, clamp it, add one shim, mortise domino, add the second shim, mortise domino, and this way my domino should be very consistent across the whole thing. And then I made this flat piece. It's a piece of MDF that's got a rim around the outside. And by sticking these vertical pieces, which are fairly small, they're 16 inches by 6 inches, in on this flat piece and sticking a shim in between the rim on the edge and the domino, I was able to use the exact same spacing shims to mortise them out. So the test pieces that I've made all fit perfectly, and as the other ones are milled exactly the same way, I'm not expecting any issues when I start to put it together. I mean, it'll be hard, but I'm not expecting to say, oh my gosh, look, this domino is sloppy or it's off or anything. I think that the domino, these are probably the most consistent dominoes I've ever cut.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So, so once this big horizontal piece, I'm happy with the finish, it'll go downstairs and then I'll start working on these vertical pieces, and they get matte black on the sides. And the front edge, which are plies of Baltic birch, get a red dye.
Oh, that's cool. It should be pretty striking.
I think so. As it's starting to come together and take shape, I'm starting to get excited by it. Like emotionally, I was done months ago, but I can now. It's starting to look like what it's supposed to. So I'm excited.
Well, cool.
I've never gotten into that much of a description of the design, but I haven't actually worked on it since the last show, as I said. What has actually been in the shop was I've been on the side kind of making this sign for my accountant, and the sign is done and installed and out of the shop. That's nice because it's been mostly done for a while and it was just in the way. So that's gone and out of the way. And currently sitting on the bench now are four wheelless Pinewood Derby cars.
Wow. When is this your last?
This is my last Pinewood Derby race, yes.
Last Pinewood Derby. Wow.
It'll be, as we're recording this, it's Wednesday, and the Pinewood Derby race will be on Saturday. So the day this posts, a mere 12 hours from when this posts at 6 a.m., I will be beginning to run the Last Pinewood Derby. And I say that not because they're my cars, they're my son's cars, but I also have the delight of actually running the race and having the race software on my computer and being in charge of making sure the whole thing runs. So we will start racing at probably about 6:20 or so. The car weigh-in is 5 to 6, and then we scrutineer. And then by the time we put the first cars on the track, it's probably about 6:15, 6:20.
Yeah. So you taking first, second, and third place? Or your son, should I say?
He's only, well, I don't shy away about helping. I mean, you can't expect, the young boys to make the car entirely on their own.
Yeah.
But I have been blown away by how much my son has done it entirely on his own this year.
Mm-hmm.
These are all skills that he's done now for 5 years, so it's not new to him. But it's been really nice to just kind of do the first one and then hand it to him and let him do the rest.
Mm-hmm.
But we're only entering one car, but we're making four, because if you only make one, you can't pick the best one and enter it.
Right. Right. So you're four and see which one's the best one.
That's, exactly.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. We had hoped to put the wheels on today, but that just didn't happen. And the rest of the week is a bit busy. We have stuff going on, so it'll probably be Saturday morning that we put the wheels on.
Yeah.
But again, the weigh-in starts at 5, and all I'm doing all day Saturday is this stupid race. So we should have plenty of time Saturday morning to get everything tuned in.
So I forgot if this was illegal or not. So are you like turning the axles and all that stuff?
The rules we run by, all you're allowed to do is sand the burrs off the axles and then polish them. So something like putting it on a lathe proper would be illegal. And they sell lots of axles where like they're milled down thinner in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to reduce friction, but it does is reduce the surface area of contact. But you have the wheel weighs the same. It's the same rotational inertia. I'm not sure if that actually interferes with the friction, but my understanding of the physics are that by removing the middle of the axle and making it a narrower diameter so that it doesn't touch the wheel hub is not only against the rules, but doesn't actually help your car. So our axles are all filed smooth. Mm-hmm. We sand them with wet dry sandpaper. Starting at 400, we go up to 1 micron.
Of course you do.
Of course you do. It's like 8 steps per axle.
Yeah.
And then they're all flattened and bent because you run the axles at a 2.5 degree bend in the back and a 1.5 degree bend in the front of the car. And what the bend does is it pulls the wheels away from the car so that you reduce the friction of the wheels riding against the car body. And it stops the wheels from like moving back and forth, wobbling on the axle. They're just pulled towards the outside. And as long as
that makes sense,
inner nail head is polished properly and the outer wheel is polished properly, you have a minimal amount of friction there and it's consistent, so it's not bouncing back and forth. And then on the front wheels, because they're beveled up, you can rotate the axle and it steers the car. So you do a bunch of tests to make sure the car is tracking straight. And as it's not tracking, you twist the axle one way or the other to correct the tracking.
Wow.
Because what you don't want is a car that just wobbles back and forth as it goes down.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So, and
there's a lot to this.
There really are. This year we're using them a second time. Last year we got fancy weights that most of the weights we have, you drill in from the bottom and they get glued into the bottom of the car and you just see these round discs in the bottom of the car. But these weights, you drill lengthwise from the back of the car towards the front and they screw in. And you can adjust the center of gravity of the car by twisting the weights and they go forward or back in the car.
Wow.
They're pretty cool.
That's
and they screw in, so you're not like the other one weights get epoxied in. They live in that car forever. You can never reuse them. In theory, I could just unscrew these and use them again next year if we were racing.
Wow, there's a lot to this.
It's stupid how much is to this. It's ridiculous at some level.
Is there a Pinewood Derby podcast out there?
Oh, I'm sure there are multiple. If I had to guess, I've never looked, but I'm sure there are many.
Wow. So what's the troupe going to do when next year when you're not around for this?
The incoming pack Cubmaster
mm-hmm.
has been the assistant Pinewood Derby guy for the last 2 years.
Oh, so okay. That's good.
He will be in a reasonable spot to take over. And all things being equal, I will not run it next year, but it would not surprise me if I was in attendance at it next year.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So do, you know, similar to the Hardwood Derby we had at Fine Woodworking Live a couple years ago.
Which I think I won.
I think so. It's, you know, I think there's still some protests that haven't been resolved. But so do y'all have like a father-son version of this where the dads build some cars and race against each other?
You know, we do not.
Okay.
For many years, we tried to do it, and we came very close to doing it about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And my thought was follow the same rules as the kids' car.
Yeah.
Every participant can enter as many cars as they want, but it's an entry fee of $20 a car, so it becomes a fundraiser.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
And but the issue we had was that the our Cub Scout pack is sponsored by a church, and they're wonderful by giving us space.
Mm-hmm.
But at official Cub Scout events, they're dry, as well they should be. But for this event, we thought it would be appropriate to make it an adults-only event and have adult beverages.
Mm-hmm.
And finding a spot where you can set up a 24-foot-long track and have adult beverages and not have to pay for the logistics became very challenging.
Right.
And far from impossible, but it became more than we wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. If the pack is able to actually do one, I'll certainly come back and chip in my money and enter a car. But
yeah,
it's something that people constantly talk about, and I've never seen one actually pulled off.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a shame, but it sounds like a good time. Well,
it will be. If you know, you want to come up Saturday night, we got plenty of time to get here.
Exactly.
We don't start racing until after 6.
And hey,
there's pizza and soda for all attendees.
Hey. Wow. So, but anyway, well, good luck to your son. So, I'm sure he's not going to need it based on the, I assume you're not the only one that goes to these extremes in building the cars, correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
Though I have a sinking suspicion, and that's all it is. And I do mean nothing to take away from their victory, but I have a sinking suspicion that the car that came in first place last year was store-bought. So this year I've bought what I believe to be is the exact same car. And Saturday I'll assemble it, and I'm just going to bring it. And if I see this car get checked in by somebody, I'm going to take mine out and say, no, sorry, this was a store-bought car. You can't.
Mm-hmm.
The rules are not particularly strict, but the crux of the rules is you have to get the kit from the BSA and you have to take what's in the box and build a car out of it. You can buy 9 of them. They're only $5 each, and you can buy 9 of them and pick the best parts and make it out of that. But you can't buy a car made by somebody else. You can't buy axles milled by somebody else, and you can't buy wheels. You're actually allowed to buy wheels that didn't come in the kit because they make wheels in different colors, and some of the kids want different colored wheels.
Right.
But you have to buy the exact same Boy Scouts of America wheel, and if the wheel doesn't say BSA stamped in the plastic on the side, they're not allowed to race. Which is unfortunate, but it's a two-page rule book that we've been using. I've been involved in this for like 8 or 9 years now, and we've used the same rule book the entire time. So it's not hard to follow the rules, and it seems like the kind of thing where you shouldn't encourage cheating.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. But yeah, like everything, there's always someone that wants to, you know, see what they can do to go around the rules. And interesting. But anyway, back to woodworking. So on to our main topic.
It's a car made of wood.
Exactly. It is. So why don't you set up our main topic for us?
All right. For those who may have attended the Northeast Woodworkers Show in... I don't know. It was probably 6 years ago, maybe 8 years ago. It was after Chris's Roubaud book.
Okay.
But before his anarchist stuff.
Okay, yeah, I know the time frame you're talking about.
And the Northeast Woodworkers Association, the NWA, has a show. They call it their showcase. Mm-hmm. Every March, April, that time of year, in Saratoga Springs. And they rent out the Saratoga Springs Convention Center, which is a moderate-sized convention center.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a marketplace, and they have an exhibition hall. And I have not been for probably 5 or 6 years, so I'm going based on what they did 5 or 6 years ago. It may have changed since then.
Yeah. Didn't you have your funeral chair at one of these?
No, that was the Long Island Woodworkers Show.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a much smaller show. It's much
okay.
The marketplace is much smaller, and it's more about the members of the club showing off their work. Whereas this had a huge exhibition hall of members showing off their work. But the last time I was at the Northeast Woodworker Show, you had Lee Nielsen there, and you know, a bunch of vendors, and they had seminars. So, Chris Schwarz was there talking about workbenches. He had just built the first workbench where the legs are mortised into the top directly.
Okay.
You know, he gets the top out of like the 1 4-inch thick slab, and has like one mortise and one dovetail, and fits the legs right into it.
Mm-hmm.
That was the bench he was showing off at the show. It's one of my earlier YouTube videos. It's a 3-part video because at the time YouTube wouldn't let you upload more than like 10 minutes.
I remember.
And
the heady days,
exactly.
Of early YouTube,
and it's him talking about this bench.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave a lecture about like the history of benches, and I love it because in the history of benches lecture, he talked about the Roman workbenches and just destroyed them and said how terrible they were. And now he's out there, you know, making Roman workbenches.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But
I actually got to sit and use one when I was at his place. Yeah, it was kind of interesting. I think there's definitely something there. I don't know if I'll build one, but. But I could see where if you're doing a lot of casework, there's some interesting ergonomics to it.
Well, think of it this way, Kyle. Yeah. It's another thing you could try a different finish on.
Exactly.
But after that show, the Long Island Woodworkers Club had actually chartered a bus and gone up to the show.
Mm-hmm.
So we had this bus full of Long Island woodworkers, Chris Schwarz, a good friend of the show, Ian from Toronto, and Ben Lowry. I think Ben Lowry was there. Bunch of guys from that area. We all went to my dad's shop up there because my dad's shop is about 25 minutes from downtown Saratoga.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a big dinner in his shop. It's a nice size shop. So I go through that whole long story to get to the shop. So I'm sure there's a listener or two who was actually at that dinner. So you'll know how big my dad's shop is. But roughly it is it's 30 by 50.
Mm-hmm.
It's in my head, I always imagine it as an 8-car garage, the way it's laid out. And I don't know if the size actually works out to that, but that's what I have in my head. And what he essentially did is he built a barn, and the living space is the second floor, which is only a little bit less than half. Maybe it's a third of the footprint of the shop.
Okay.
And the shop, on the one hand, the floor is wonderful, smooth concrete with radiant heat in it. It's delightful.
Mm-hmm.
And the walls are insulated very well. and the interior is some plywood. I think it's a little sheetrock and a little bit of just exposed insulation. So the interior of the walls is still a work in progress.
Okay.
And in this space, which he has never really taken the time to fully set up, because it was never his full-time house. It was just a vacation house and a weekend house. And he's got two bandsaws. He's got his big old grizzly table saw. He's got a nice, huge, along one whole wall, this big miter station with a Bosch glide saw in it.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
He's got my old DeWalt 13-inch benchtop planer.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got my old 6-inch jet joiner. And basically set up with the bandsaw in the middle, the table saw in the middle, the two bandsaws kind of back to back with a post in between them, kind of in the middle of the shop also, and then bench space along the walls. So that's where his current, let's call it his production shop, is, because he has a shop in his garage at home also. And these days, the shop in the garage is probably a little bit better outfitted, but it doesn't have a joiner or a planer in it right now.
Oh, okay.
So he's taken this big 30 by 50 space and going to be changing it to a mezzanine he's going to build in our warehouse at work. And the way the mezzanine is going to lay out, it's either going to be 13 by 60 or 13 by 50, depending on where they end it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be, let's say it's as long a space, but, only a third as wide.
Right, right.
So he was.
So this is going to be in the same building.
No. It's not. It's moving from Greenwich to Long Island.
Okay, so this is going to be at your. It's going to be a mezzanine at your at the workspace. It's
exactly.
Gonna be,
exactly.
Yeah, it's going to be a mezzanine. It's so you're actually building a mezzanine, and then he's going to move his shop onto that mezzanine.
Yeah, the way our building is built, there's kind of like this. It's almost like an alley. Like it was an extension put on years before we bought the building.
Mm-hmm.
But it's this 13-foot wide. By the whole thing is probably 100 foot long that runs along the side of the building. And some of it is already a mezzanine that we use as locker rooms and more storage. So the section that doesn't have a mezzanine above it, he's going to put a mezzanine in that section, which is going to get him 13 by 50, 13 by 60, depending on how he builds it.
Yeah. So he's basically moving from like 1500 square feet down to what? 650. If I made my calculations correctly.
Like yeah.
Wow, that's quite a change.
It is a little bit of a change.
Yeah. So how big is his miter saw station? Because that seems.
Oh, his miter saw station right now is probably 30 foot long.
30 foot long.
Something
yeah.
like that. Maybe it's 20. I mean, it takes up an entire. It's on one of the 30 foot walls of his current shop, and is not the full length of the wall, but is most of it.
Hmm.
Maybe it's only like 17 or 18. Maybe it's an 8-foot sheet on either side of the saw or something like that.
Yeah.
So I would think that that needs to certainly can't move in its current size.
Mm.
But in terms of the saw, the fact that he has a Bosch Glide, I think bodes well for him, because I know like that's the only saw I would ever buy at this point, because it's such a small footprint. And it can be tucked so tightly against a wall.
Right.
I think of it like a longer version of my shop. My shop is just under 10 by 22. So
yeah.
His would be half again as long. No, I'm sorry. His would be two and a half to three times as long. But only a couple foot wider than my shop.
Mm-hmm.
And I have my shop set up very linearly, as I feel you need to in a narrow space like this. So I would assume that he's going to end up having to do something similar to that. He can pack a lot more in because he has a lot more walls to pack against. But you're not in a 13-foot wide space. In my head, you're not putting a table saw in the middle. It's just not big enough, I don't think. I think you're putting it against the side.
Yeah. It's got to be up against the side. So I guess, you know, and it can't be one of those 52, you know, with the extension tables where it's 52 inches either. It's got, you got it. Of course. Yeah. That's what he has. He's got to get a smaller, table. I think because my shop's kind of like looks like a Tetris figure, but, at its narrowest, it's about 14 and a half feet wide. So it's fairly close to the 13. But yeah, I got my table saw. It's got, I guess it's the 32 inch or not the 54 or what, 52 or whatever it is. And I got that up against the, you know, wall basically. That's never been a problem. I've never had to cut something so big that I had to, you know, that it was a problem. Mm-hmm. If it is, I do have my saw on a mobile base, which you might want to do, and you could move it around if you did have a piece that big. But well, what does he build? I mean, is he building
any? a lot of sheet good carcasses, and he is the person who puts a 4x8 sheet of plywood on his table saw.
Okay.
But at the same time, like I'm not that person. I have a track saw, and if I'm cutting down a full sheet, it's in the driveway. But I look at my saw, which had 32-inch rails,
mm-hmm.
and I took a hacksaw to the rails and I cut them, so it's only got 22-inch rails now, and it's mm-hmm. that much tighter against the wall, and I won that much space around it. I don't know. He doesn't strike me as making those compromises.
Okay.
I think he's going to want to still. I don't know that the space is conducive to breaking down sheet goods on a table saw. But I think that he'll still want to be able to do that.
Okay. Now, you said this is going to be a mezzanine. So does he have to put lumber storage in this mezzanine?
Presumably.
Okay.
And presumably, we have a forklift, and I'm mm-hmm. presuming that he'll build some sort of a lift into it. So physically getting items up to the mezzanine, I don't think will be a problem.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm trying to think about the way you can design it. But in my head, it's just you're basically just running things down the wall.
Right, yeah.
He doesn't have a big joiner or planer. He's got the mm-hmm. benchtop planer and a 6-inch joiner. But like when I think about my space, I was toying with getting one of the combo machines. Like you have a combo, right?
Yeah, I got the Jet 12-inch combo, yeah.
Right. Now, in my space, I think that the footprint of that device, while not big in terms of this total square footage, because the top needs to flip up out of the way,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of football-shaped in terms of its footprint, and it ends mm-hmm. up being too wide to fit in a narrow space. I truly think that my 8-inch jointer and 15-inch planer, independent of one another, are more efficient because they're both about 15 inches wide, and I never need it to be wider than that. Even though you know they're longer than yours is, certainly, but I have the length and not the width, and I think mm-hmm. he'll be in the same position.
Yeah, he probably will. Mine, like I said, I'm about 14 and a half, and I can – where my joiner and table saw are, my joiner probably cheats into some space to the side. But it's almost in – both of them are almost in that 14 and a half inch wide area. I have my joiner on the – if I'm looking down my shop, on the far right-hand side. If there was a wall there, there isn't, but it's almost where the wall is. It's on the right-hand side of the wall. And then probably about from the end of that joiner is probably about 3 to 4 foot. And then there's the table saw, which is on the far other side, the right-hand side. So I got the joiner on the left-hand side and the table saw pushed all the way to the right-hand side.
That's what I have, but I only
have about... Yeah, and I can get by. There's about, you know, walking through there, there's probably two or three feet I can get by relatively easy, and it hadn't been a problem. But at 13 foot, I think you're probably going to lose a foot of what I have. And yeah, that then it's going to start getting real tight, especially if you're moving projects around and whatnot.
Like, I have my jointer is in front of the outfeed wing for my miter saw.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, really, it's just like a weekend between me and having this thing on a mobile base. I have, you know, custom welded brackets that are fit underneath it. I have these big wheels. I have to take my power switches, stick up above the table behind them, and I need to move that so it's on the face of the machine.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll be able to roll this underneath the outfeed wing instead of having it in front of the outfeed wing. So that I had to make my miter saw height based on the jointer. And then it all kind of backed away from being able to fit the jointer underneath it. And the jointer, you know, it's an 8-inch parallelogram jointer. It's for what it is, it's big. So I needed a reasonable amount of height. Now, I don't mind the miter saw being higher than normal because it's a little closer to the eye and it's not awkwardly high. So I'm losing space by not having it on a mobile base, and I need to be able to tuck it underneath the wing of the miter saw. That being said, I think that his space will be long enough that he can just put it against the wall down further. I don't think he'll need to be able to pull it out from under the miter saw because it's a longer space.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. I would tuck it up onto the same side. I mean, how often is he using the joiner though? If he's doing mainly plywood type projects.
At this point, I don't know if he uses it at all, but I presume
he'll get more frames and stuff like that, maybe.
He had an old Delta 6-inch, like one of the ones where the fence was mounted to the end of the infeed table as opposed to back.
Mm-hmm.
Neat machine. He actually took off about a quarter inch of one of his ring fingers on that machine. But I don't
Alrighty.
Think, what's that?
That's it. Alrighty.
That was one of the times when I was in college and got the phone call that everything was okay. And I was like, what do you mean everything's okay? What happened?
You run into a lot of accidents.
Yeah. But
I guess it's the nature of the work.
Well, I haven't yet to take my fingers off.
Well, I know, but I mean, you're around people that are constantly, dealing with hazardous machinery, so to speak.
Yeah.
I can imagine the roofing stories you have.
The roofing stories are more about the falls than the.
Yeah, that's what I figured. Yeah, people falling off.
Yeah. I still hold the record at work for the most stitches.
Oh, that's nice.
That's only 36.
36? Ah, that's not too bad.
Nah, it's not bad. And you know what? Chicks dig scars.
That's right. That's right.
So I think that the joiner will be used more often as he gets away from needing to build essentially built-ins for the house. And I have to believe that once he starts to use the joiner a lot, he will quickly outgrow the 6-inch joiner.
Right.
But,
you know, if he's got 13 feet wide and he's got a hell of a lot of length, he could go to however big a joiner he wants and I think be fine.
I would absolutely agree because the reality is switching to an 8 or even a 12-inch one, the width is not growing substantially. It's growing by 4, 5, 6 inches. It gets longer, but he's got the length, so I think that should be fine. I was also kind of thinking about dust collection, but that ultimately becomes easy. You run a trunk down the ceiling.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not rocket science.
And it could be interesting, you know, if he's got, you know, most of his machinery is on the right hand side or the left hand side of this space, he could just run something. How? Yeah, that How tall is
It's probably 8 or 9 feet to this to the underside of the roof.
Okay.
Once he's on the mezzanine, something like that. It's not. It's not. It's a. It's neither particularly high nor low.
Low.
It's probably a little bit taller than a standard ceiling. I'm trying to think what the ceiling is in my shop. The ceiling in my shop is more than 8 foot. It's probably 9, maybe it's 10, but it's probably 9. That's about what the ceiling would be for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 That's definitely workable.
Well, you know what? It's got to be 10 plus because my walls are lined with the OSB.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the OSB is 8 foot, and there's easily 24 inches above the OSB. Like I just have exposed on the one wall. I filled it in with OSB, but on the back wall, it's just exposed insulation above the OSB, and it's got to be every bit of 2 foot above the OSB, so I probably have 10-foot ceilings in here.
No, well, that's nice. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the ceilings have, there's not, at least to get back to my shop for a minute, there isn't an inch of ceiling that doesn't have something hanging from it, but, you know, it's fine. I'm able to fit everything and have room, so that's nice. I have one of those racks that fits above the garage door, so it's probably about 4 foot by 4 foot, and it's a big mesh rack. And when the garage door rolls up, the garage door ends up underneath where this rack is.
Right, right. Yeah, I've seen those. So that's pretty cool.
It allowed me to store a lot more. Like, yeah, it's a very useful rack. It's where I keep the miscellaneous. It's like the standard dimensional lumber I keep up there. I like just 1x4s and nothing fancy. Mm-hmm. Any actual hardwood goes in my actual lumber rack.
So, yeah, that's going to be interesting. I think he's got – I think the way this is going to set up, he should have plenty of space. He just might – you know, he's definitely going to miss the width he has currently. But I think it's definitely something he can work within.
I would absolutely agree.
Yeah.
As I think about it, he doesn't have the current big shop – so fitted out with tools that he's never going to fit them in there. I think that every bit of power equipment he has will fit in the new space. It's probably going to be just be more mentally coming to terms with the new space than actually not having enough room to fit the space in.
Yeah. But I would suggest he puts everything on some sort of mobile base, because I think, you know, he's going to find as he works that, oh, well, no, I'd rather have the table saw here rather than there. And same thing with the joiner, depends on how his workflow goes.
Yeah. You know, on the face of it, I am not a fan of mobile bases because I don't like moving the stuff around all that much. But as I sit here and look at the equipment in my shop, the only piece of equipment that doesn't have a mobile base is my joiner. And as I said earlier, I'm like building this Frankenstein mobile base for it anyway.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to be said for a mobile base. I'm not the kind of person who wants to have to pull a tool out every time they use it. I want it basically to be functional where it is. But in this small space, you need to be able to move it out of the way sometimes. And at those times, the mobile base is invaluable.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. I hardly ever move my tools, but I think I'm in the same ballpark you are, because all of my tools are on mobile base except for my jointer. And I don't really plan to put that on a mobile base, but yeah.
As long as you don't need to roll it underneath your miter saw outfeed table, you should be fine.
No, I don't. But yeah, almost everything is, and for the same reason, you know, I got, you know, if I have to prep for a hurricane, I need to move everything and puts things on top of each other, and yeah, it's a mess. But that's really the only time I move my stuff. Like I said, I got my table saw on this mobile base. I got the saw stop, and I got the fancy saw stop mobile base. It's hydraulic, and it's just wonderful. But I maybe use that maybe once a year tops. Mm-hmm. Probably not. Probably once every 2 years. Usually that's if I'm doing, and really the last time I used it was a few months ago, and that's just when I did a deep clean of the shop. So I just want to move it out of the way a little bit to clean underneath of it and around it. So, but yeah, I hardly ever move that, and don't move my joiner. Drill press is on a mobile base. Yeah. So yeah, I'm in the same ball game you are.
Yeah, it needs to be nice and stable when you're not moving it and movable. Mm-hmm. I don't think you need one that's like you're moving all the time. But
yeah, and the worst one I have is probably on my drill press. And I've thought time and time again, I either need to get a better one or get that thing off the mobile base. I mean, it's workable, but it is a little janky sometimes.
Yeah, and like the reason I'm making one for my joiner is because all the mobile bases available for the joiner, because it's not light. I think when I was setting it up, I think the manual says it weighs something like 600 or 700 pounds. They're all designed with two wheels that are fixed and two wheels that rotate. I mean, they all roll like wheels, but that rotate the direction. And the fixed wheels are always set up to roll parallel with the joiner.
Right.
And I don't need to roll it, you know, down the length of my shop. I need to be able to pull it out from the wall and push it back against the wall. So, the wheels that I have, which I may end up replacing before I assemble this thing, the wheels I have are all rotatable. And I think I may want fixed wheels that are just set up so that the thing only rolls side to side, not lengthwise. Because I really only need to pull it out from the wall, use it, and push it back against the wall. I'm not moving it in the shop, per se. Whereas my planer is on two fixed wheels and one spinning one. And I do pull that. It's kind of against the side now. And if I needed to plane something small, I could do it just like it is. But if I'm going to send some giant boards through, I tend to pull it more into the middle of the shop to use it.
Right, right. Now, you have that Laguna bandsaw. Do you have the mobility kit for that?
Where I do.
It's kind of okay.
I almost didn't get it, and it was like an extra $100 on the saw. So it's not cheap, but it has two fixed wheels in kind of on the arm side, on the left side where the arm comes up, and then on the right side there's a foot, and it has this long metal pole with wheels at the bottom of it that catches the hook, and you use it as a pivot, and you lift that end of the saw up, and it spins pretty freely, and it takes a little bit of getting used to. It's kind of like steering a wagon the way it works, but it's pretty easy to move. And right now, because I have so much crap in my shop, I have that saw tight up against the wall, and I was able to cut Pinewood Derby cars on it with no issue. But if I want to cut anything longer than like 14 or 15 inches, I have to move it from where it is now. But with that with that little arm thing, it's really, really quick to move around.
Now, is there a way you could use that to move your joiner? Maybe copy that mobility kit and use that same arm?
I probably could, but a couple things is that because I'm moving the joiner essentially across the narrow end of the narrow dimension of my shop.
Yeah, the pole.
The pole down enough to give the
leverage, that makes
it might stick out too much.
Yeah.
Because that's the one thing I note is I'm banging the pole into things as I move it around.
Okay, yeah.
But the other thing is, like I said, the joiner weighs between 600 and 700 pounds. My bandsaw, maybe it weighs 200.
Yeah,
it's a heavy duty enough thing, but it's not cast iron. You know, it's a European style one, so it's all folded steel. So maybe it weighs half as much, but it's probably more like a third or a quarter. So I don't know. I think I would have to again just get lots of leverage on this thing, which would make it stick out that much that far, which would probably make it in the way.
Right. Yeah, you could move it. Yeah, move it 3 inches out. Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So, but again, to get back to his shop, I think that the idea of everything being mobile is important for setup and adjustment. And in a narrow space like that, where the tools are basically against the wall, it's nice.
To have that.
It's nice to be able to move them into the middle to use them occasionally. But in a 13-foot wide space, I don't really see any of them living in the middle. I think they're all going to have to live against the wall.
Yeah, I think so too. And like I said, I don't think that's going to be an issue. It's just going to be something he's going to have to get used to.
Yeah. I think that's the biggest component of this is just going to be coming to terms with the new space.
Yeah. And if he does decide to go mobile, just make sure, you know, go ahead and invest the money on some good mobile kits.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You get what you pay for with those kits, and it's important to get the heavy duty ones.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, some of them, like, you know, I've looked at my jointer and the way the base of it is, I could basically add heavy duty casters to the bottom of it and be able to move it around. Because, you know, it has, in the base of it, it has those holes. So you could put, you know, those casters that have the little stud that comes right through, not the ones that bolt, but the ones that have the, I guess, the threaded rod that you can then cinch down. You could probably put those on my jointer and be able to move it around. I just never have looked at doing that. But that's certainly an option to see, you know, hey, what does the base look like? Is it drilled out for those type of casters or what? You know, so that's an option. I think, you know, just looking at, you know, how the base is formed, because mine seemed to be, you know, like designed to do that if you wanted to. Because I know when I got mine, it actually had bolts running through those holes that held it down to the pallet that it came on. So.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't, you know, you'd have to look at the base on his machines and see, but you know, they make those super heavy duty casters that I guess they're on these little, oh, I forgot what they call it. They're kind of expensive, but to move it, you actually had to go to each wheel and turn a little dial to actually raise it off the foot onto the caster.
I know the ones you're talking about.
Yeah.
And they're better for the long-term ones because it doesn't live on the caster. It lives on that
right.
foot. And then yeah. you would either adjust the foot up or the caster down or vice versa.
Yeah, something like that.
To get it to
yeah.
move. I think Paul Marcel has them on some of his things. For some reason, I remember him writing a post about them.
Hmm.
They always struck me as a lot of twisting a little knob to get the wheels to go up and down.
Yeah.
Maybe you're just twisting them in the beginning and then leaving it like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. But, you know, if you're like, you know, if it's like, you know, some of my machinery, which doesn't move hardly at all, but maybe once a year, or if that, you know, yeah, sure, it's a pain, but it's not that big of a deal to do.
Hmm.
So, and those, if I remember right, those things sure did look, you know, beefy and sturdy.
Yeah, and the floor, I'm not sure what the floor will be. It'll probably be plywood, but it'll be mm-hmm. certainly be smooth and even. It's not like, you know, a 100-year-old basement or something. So, I think it should be workable in that regard. I think the biggest change is going to be mindset as opposed to actual equipment setup.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said getting stuff up and down is not going to be a problem because I was thinking, okay, if he's doing large case work, you know, hey, I got this built. Now it's on the mezzanine. I need to get it down the first floor.
Yeah, I presume he's going to build in some sort of a lift. But even if he doesn't, we have a forklift. So,
okay.
I don't foresee it being a problem.
Yeah. Now what's living below this mezzanine? I mean, is there any issues with any dust getting generated that might fall on?
No. Okay. It's one side is a wall full of drains and drain components.
Mm-hmm.
And the other wall is a little bit of metal accessories, but mostly termination bar. So you should be fine.
Okay, cool. Well, I don't know if we solved his issues, but I think we've definitely determined that it's workable.
Oh yeah, yes, we have. So go and move all that stuff, Dad, and then you.
Yeah, I think you should buy all new equipment, though. just sell what he has in the other shop, and you know, just buy new stuff, have it delivered there, and you know. Just go all out. Why not?
Let him know.
Now, you said he has two bandsaws, so he's going to move both of those up there?
Presumably. He may take one home, but he's got an old, you know, the Delta 14-inch cast iron.
Okay, yeah.
And he's got a Jet. I think it's a 16-inch saw, but it's a mm-hmm. European-style saw. It's Jet has that line where the big arm that comes up is a triangle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's got one of those saws. I think it's 16, but I'm not, maybe it's 18. It's a bigger saw.
Yeah.
So he's got that. And I don't know if he'll, I don't know if he'll keep them together or bring one to the house and one to the, I don't think he's very fond of the Delta having the Jet now.
Yeah.
So I think he might be more inclined to get rid of the Delta and buy a second, you know, European style saw. I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
But with the band saws, relatively speaking, they're lightweight and easy to move. So I would think with the band saws, keep them next to each other against the wall, and you basically pull out the one you want to use.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And that's what I do with mine. Mine's on a mobile base, and I do keep it up against the wall, and I'll pull it out if I need to. And usually the only reason I need to pull it out is if I need to get to the wheels for some reason.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, to open up the case to get to the wheels, you know, I need a little space behind the saw. But if I don't, most of the time, I don't need to. So it just lives up against the wall.
Yeah, the actual footprint of a bandsaw is so nice and small that it's very easy to just push it against the wall.
Yeah, yeah. I would like to, I'll probably never do this, but I would like to build something around my table to get a larger table on the bandsaw. But I may do with those rigid outfeed tables.
Yeah.
Those are fine. Do they still make those?
They are different now, but I believe they still do. It's like a, ours are, they're not quite an oval, but they're basically like a rectangle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the new ones are kind of six-sided or
probably
eight-sided.
I haven't even noticed. I don't
know. They're a little bit different, but I believe they still do make them.
Hmm. Well, there's a recommendation for y'all out there. Get some of those.
I want to say in one of the first bandsaw modification tweaking tune-up articles that Michael Fortune wrote for Fine Woodworking, he talks about building outfeed tables.
Yeah, I might have to look into that. The only thing is you know, you got to be able to easily remove it if you need to tilt your table and I suppose
that's true. I very rarely do.
But yeah, me too. Me too.
I was excited that it had a rack and pinion tilt for the table.
Yeah.
I was like, I've yet to adjust it off 90.
there's been some times I've actually tilted my table, but they're few and far between. But it does come up occasionally.
This is a complete non sequitur, but it makes me think of the big bandsaws like boat builders use, where they'd set a bandsaw in a pit, and the table stays flat and the saw rotates to create angles rather than vice versa.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen that before. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, they have one of those saws up at Mystic Seaport. It's a beast.
Yeah, that's not going to fit in a 13 by 50 spot.
No, probably not.
But having that as a mezzanine, you could build the shop around that bandsaw.
Exactly. Since the bandsaw has to like live in a pit so that it can rotate properly, you could just have it dip down below the mezzanine.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I think your dad would get a kick out of that. Yeah.
Yeah, but then he would just never change it off 90.
That's true. Never use the functionality. But damn it, if I need to... I'm ready to go. Well, with that said, should we move on to our fortnightly beer choices?
We should.
So, I guess I'll start. Due to my recovery, I am, of course, abstaining from alcohol. Just want to get my body time to recover without having to process anything else. But my meds and whatnot. So. I'm drinking started off the evening with a little orange juice and finishing up with a little LaCroix orange sparkling water.
Ooh.
Yes, yes, yes. I've been a big LaCroix drinker for years and years and years, not just when I got hip here recently.
I was going to say, LaCroix is like the seltzer choice these days.
I know. I've been drinking it, golly, probably 8 years or something like that. I gave up soft drinks. And I started drinking LaCroix when I gave up soft drinks. Now, I'll still have the occasional Coke or something if I'm out at a restaurant or something like that. But, you know, as far, I was one of those guys that would drink, you know, 3 or 4 Cokes a day, you know. So, you know, started up in the morning, didn't drink coffee, but yeah, let me pound a couple of Cokes down. Oh. Yeah. So I got off that about 8 years or so ago, and been drinking LaCroix ever since. So.
Well, you stay on that recovery train.
Yeah, exactly. So, what are you drinking?
I am I'm plowing through my stash of Alchemist. Tonight I'm enjoying a Heady Topper, which is one of their New England IPAs. It is the what does it say it is? It's an American Double India Pale Ale. It is a New England IPA. They can call it an American Double Pale Ale, but I'm sorry, the guys in Vermont, the Alchemists especially, really only know how to make New England IPAs, and they do it, you know, they do it well. So I don't mean that in any way disparagingly, but I would not for a second call this an American ale. It is a New England IPA, and that said, it's very good. It's got a nice brightness to it. It's dank. It's a little bitter. It's delightful.
Oh, well, that sounds fantastic. Hopefully in another 3 or 4 weeks I can join you.
Can I put them on my carry-on?
I don't know. I don't see why not.
I've had them, like, pull out.
Well, a carry-on. No, probably not a carry-on, but if you check baggage. Yeah, if you check baggage, you probably could.
If I check them, will it pop, like, with the pressure difference? It's a can.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Sorry, you got to come up here.
Well, no, it couldn't pop because they serve beer in cans on the plane. So,
yeah, but they're inside the cape. Like, isn't the luggage compartment less pressurized than the cabin?
Maybe, but it can't. But I think it's pretty much the same pressure. I don't know. I'm sure someone out there knows. But don't they? Don't some animals and stuff like that travel in the baggage area?
I don't know. The last time I checked a bag was many, many years ago. But yeah. dear listener, if you're familiar with the pressure differentials of commercial air travel, please let me know, because I'm not opposed to checking a bag if it means that I get to bring Kyle some nice New England beer.
Yeah. See, now I saw for those that you don't know, I guess we didn't make that announcement, but Diami is coming down here for the Texas Woodworking Festival in Austin on April 6th, I think.
Yeah.
So for those of you all in the Texas area that are planning on attending, we will be there in spades.
What is the website for that, Kyle?
It is, let me pull it up here. It is, oh, it's great. It's called TexasWoodworkingFestival.com. Yes, and it is April 6th, 2019 in Austin, Texas. And they're getting all their safety permits and stuff like that done, and they should be selling tickets here shortly.
I believe tickets go on sale February 1st.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yep, on sale February 1st.
Now, the Woodworking Festival, just to let people know, it is a – it sounds – I'm very excited to go. I did not go last year. This is their second year. And the description on their website is, when a beer festival meets a woodworking convention, you get the Texas Woodworking Festival. Join us for a day of food, drinks, and all things woodworking. The Texas Woodworking Festival is styled like a woodworking-themed farmer's market and will exhibit locally made custom furniture, booths selling tools and woodworking wares, as well as vendors demonstrating new woodworking projects. Grab a friend, woodworking stickers to trade, and join us at the second annual Texas Woodworking Festival. So it's going to be a very... Correct me if I'm wrong, Kyle. You were there last year, but what I envision is a very casual, social, just having a good time talking about woodworking day.
Yeah, I was there last year, and this last year was kind of like, hey, let's all get together at this brewery in, you know, talk about woodworking, had a couple of booths set up with some makers and some other folks like local area sawmills and whatnot. And it was really fun. And I had a great time there, and it was exactly that. I think this year they're, you know, ramping it up a little bit and getting, you know, some actual tool vendors there. I don't think there's anything out there to publicly announce yet, but I have heard that there's going to be some good sponsors, some good vendors there. Well, I'm sure the announcements will come out soon. Yeah.
They have sponsors and vendors on their website already, but before I get to them, I wanted to talk about the ticket. They have not announced what tickets will go for. I presume it'll be a fairly reasonable fee, but the ticket gets you all access to the event, an open bar, and a raffle ticket. So I'd be curious really what they're raffling away. But in terms of sponsors, they've got Fine Lumber, which I presume is a local Austin lumberyard.
Yeah.
They'll be giving away a Festool sander from Texas Toolcraft, $100 gift card from Belforest, a Rubio Monocoat starter kit, and boots from Helm Boots, Lusage Boots.
Yeah. One of their sponsors is a bootmaker, and that's going to be really interesting. They make some custom made boots, and we're not talking about cowboy boots. I think they probably make those too, but actual work type boots. So
yeah, it's a nice looking boot shown in the picture. But in terms of the exhibitors and vendors, we've got Texas Heritage Woodworks. It'll be nice to see them again.
Mm-hmm.
Harvest Lumber Company, Philip Morley Furniture will be there. I'm very excited to meet Philip.
Oh yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah. Router Space, Rentable C&Cs. I don't know them. That's actually pretty neat. Do you know Router Space is a company?
No, I don't. I don't.
I'm presuming you rent the machine, or do you just rent the time on the machine and they program it for you? That'll be interesting to talk to them.
Yeah.
Skull Mechanics Brewery, the Austin School of Furniture and Design. I wonder why they're there. Industry Print Shop, Dowd's Vintage and Antique Tools, Vintage Tool Retailer. Have you dealt with them?
Yes. That guy is up in Carrollton, Texas, and he is in Texas, if you want the old antique tools, that's the place you go.
Okay.
He's real famous about having a annual sale or twice annual sale. So two times a year, they'll have a big sale, and it's, you know, people lining up outside the place and going in. It's actually out of his house, believe it or not. And, you know, he has a huge backyard just, you know, and all these little outbuildings are just stuffed with all kinds of, you know, vintage tools. You know, Texas is one of those places where you go to an antique store or anything of that nature, the last thing you're going to find is tools. And if you ever do find them, they're, you know, beat to hell. Mm-hmm. Somehow this guy's got insight into getting these tools, and he sells them at a real reasonable price. And over the last few years, he's been making it out to various events. So it's real exciting. And anytime I'm in the Dallas area, I give him a call and say, "Hey, mind if I come by and see what you got?" He goes, "What are you looking for?" And I'll tell him what I'm looking for or what I'm interested in. And you can go over there, and he's got a few of them pulled out ready for you to do. And like I said, his prices are extremely reasonable. We would go to Woodworking in America, and they would have a couple of antique dealers there. And I've been through, you know, all the stuff they brought. His stuff was just as good, if not better, and at far better prices too.
Oh, that's good.
So I'm excited about that. There's, you know, I've been talking a little bit to Austin, back and forth, chatting back and forth.
Yeah, that's Austin who is organizing the event with the Texas.
Austin Waldo.
Not the city.
Yeah, not the city. But Austin Waldo. And, there's a couple other sponsors that, looks like that's going to come through. That's going to be exciting.
I've heard that we're a sponsor.
You know, I heard we're going to be there, and we might be doing some interviews, you know, and I think we might actually be doing the raffle.
Oh.
Which means, unfortunately, I don't think we'll be able to enter. Darn it. But anyway. But
that's all right.
That's the price we pay. But yeah, anyone that's going to be in the Texas area, that's, you know, anywhere in Texas or one of the surrounding states, it's definitely worth the road trip.
You know what? If I can fly down from New York, you can get exactly. The car and drive a few hours. Come on.
Exactly.
You get to see Kyle. What? That's all you really need.
Exactly. And I'll be wearing my hat.
You better.
Yeah. So
I'll have a backpack full of recording gear.
Good. We're all set then. Let me see. What else did I want to talk to you about? Beer wise, Dogfish Head.
Yes.
So I, you know, as I'm recovering, I'm looking to get more healthy, and I noticed they have a line of new healthy beer, so to speak. They
healthy
have
being a relative thing. Yes, they do. They have their. Yes. There's Sequench, which they've been marketing for a yeah. while as it's a
yeah,
it's not bad for a beer for a sour that's made with salt.
Yeah,
which are two things I don't like in beer. Yeah. It's actually not bad at all.
Huh. And then it looks like they have something called a Super 8, which is supposed to have all the I guess what do they call it, the super juices and fruits and stuff. Mm. Yeah, prickly pear, mango, boysenberry, blackberry, raspberry, elderberry, kiwi juices, toasted guana, and I'm looking at here, and red Hawaiian sea salt. Now, so have you had that?
Dogfish Head just, I have not had that one.
Yeah.
That strikes me as a more brewery and tap house release than a public, than a truly public release through distribution. Mm-hmm. But we get relatively good distribution here, but I know there are lots of beers that are only released at the tap houses and the brewery. Do you mm-hmm. guys get distribution at all?
Yeah. I can go to any of our, you know, not the corner store, of course, mm-hmm. but any of our well-stocked liquor stores. And, you can find Dogfish Head. Yeah, and the other one that this is what got me on this because I saw some sort of announcement about this is called Slightly Mighty, and it's a 95 calorie, 3.6 carb beer. So I guess it's competing with the what is it, the Michelob Light mm-hmm. crowd, and that one looks interesting too. And it's got a 4%. Alcohol content. I don't know what the Michelob is, but anyway, I just wondered if you'd tried any of these.
No, those I have not. As I said, most of them I think are either brand new or mm-hmm. in the, you know, very close geographic release area. I have tried the Sequench, which is not a style I'm particularly fond of, but I will still be more than willing to have one or two because they're done really well. That's what Dogfish Head, I feel, does, is that they do everything they do very well. Some of the stuff they do is brilliant, and some of it's like, okay, mm-hmm. I don't really like that, but okay. So I don't doubt that they're all going to be good for what they are. Some of them will be wonderful. Some of them will be only okay. But I would think absolutely worth trying. And within those realms, if that's a style you're looking for, I'm sure they will do it well.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I was just curious. So well, appreciate the
driving,
input.
I would stop by Dogfish Head on my way to see you.
No, that's a hell of a drive.
Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah. That's a 3-day drive right there. Probably. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So, well, why don't we let everybody know where they can find us? So where can they find you, Deion? Well,
I can be found at modernwoodworkersassociation.com, at penultimatewoodshop.com, at Deion Plotkey on Twitter, or at penultimatewoodshop on the Instagram.
And I can be found on Instagram, the only social media platform that matters, at barton.kyle. And with that, that just about wraps it up for this show. So if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes or Google Play Music. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association, then you'll never miss any of our exciting episodes. And while you're there, leave us a review.
Thank you for listening. If you like the show, be sure to visit modernwoodworkersassociation.com. You can follow the MWA on Twitter at @MWA_national, on Instagram at @MWA_podcast, and you could like us on Facebook. And the best thing you can do is tell a friend, because word of mouth goes a long way in sharing the discussion. And as we seem to just be adding lots and lots to the normal format of the show, now that we're all done, let me just also throw out a reminder that Fine Woodworking Live is coming up. And that'll be in Sturbridge, Massachusetts, as it has been for the past few years. And I'll be there again, and it'll be a good time.
Have they opened up reservations yet?
They have.
Oh, they have. Wow.
They have, yes.
Yeah, this whole thing. Usually I check in it once a week. Okay, I know what I'm doing in a few minutes. Yeah.
So Kyle will be there too, and we'll have a good time. So if you're not able to go down to Austin for the day, come to Massachusetts for the weekend. And
yes.
With that, go into your shop, squeeze it so it's nice and narrow, and build something fun.